Okay, just a minute. Like, what do you want it on?
Let's do 40 minutes. Okay. And that will go over, but that'll, or 45 or something. Time. 40 or 45. Keep us honest.
There we go.
Because we know if I say the words, yes, we'll keep us. We'll have a short one today.
Right.
If I dare utter those words, that means we will be 2 hours long today.
Okay. Timer on.
Timer
we
on.
Are a go.
I feel like there's some pressure now. I'm like, right. Oh, somehow that wall clock is judging me.
Yes.
Oh goodness. Oh, here, let me turn some of these other things off that we don't need. Yeah. So okay, Andrew, I have to ask you. So one. Hey, just the very presence of me recording this, I survived my bike race.
Yes. It was still in one piece. I can validate that.
And yeah, at least on the outside. Right. Internally, maybe, you know, yeah. I'm dying inside. No, it was actually, but it was a ton of fun, actually. Yeah.
It's just 50 miles, not 50K.
Right. It's 50 miles. Yes, yeah. Right. So what is that? Like 80K, 80 something? Something like that. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was great. And so it was a 2,600 foot climb. So it was like, what's that?
Which
like
is really impressive.
We have such an international audience too. I'm like 850 meters somewhere in there, between 800 and 900 meters.
Right.
So pretty, but it was spread out. So it wasn't terribly, wasn't terribly bad.
Yep.
So it was really nice. I had a great time. I had two riding partners that I went with. So it was a little group of three.
Yep.
And that was fantastic. It really, because they have a rule that you're not allowed to wear headphones.
Okay.
For safety, because you're on the road and it's shared road and they don't close the streets and stuff. Yep. So I get it, but I always have my headphones
I
in.
I know
right?
We have this conversation. Yeah.
And they're in pass-through mode. So I can actually hear the road. I would argue sometimes even better because you don't get the buffeting of the wind.
You are such a cyclist. You've always got an excuse for what you do.
Give me the road, man. Give me the road. But yeah, so riding with those other the fellow cyclists was great because I didn't miss not having, I was worried about that, honestly, that I was like, oh man, am I going to just get lost in my thoughts up that hill and like second guess everything? But no, it was great. There was only one moment. It was at, I think it was like mile 47. So right at the very end. So it was basically uphill for 25 miles and then downhill for 25 miles. But at the end, the downhill gets kind of jaggy. Yep. So there's like these rocks. And there was one last, it wasn't very long in duration, but it was a pretty steep climb.
Yep.
And there was that moment where I'm pedaling as hard as I can. I'm doing this thing, right? And I'm just going, I'm like, there was this moment of doubt because my legs, my legs. All of a sudden, I stopped like feeling them in the way. And I was like, and I know
completely
that feeling.
Jellified. Yes. Yeah.
And when they go to rubber or jelly, there's a moment where I'm like, oh no. And I have this vision of those like marathon runners who cross the line and they're just like, they completely lose control.
So you need to do it after the line, not just before.
And I had this thought where I was like, oh my God, this could happen to me going uphill on this thing. And I'm just like, of course, you know, you'll tip right over, it'll be a whole mess. And I'll be like, oh my God. So I just had this moment where I was like, not at mile 47. This does not happen. Yep. And it did.
You pushed through.
I pushed through. I made it. It's one of those things where your brain just, just tell your brain to not, you know, just keep going.
And so presumably, it's so many years since I've done any serious cycling, but presumably your feet are locked in. Have you got the shoes with the locks or?
No. Yes. And this is the other part that I find humorous is, of course, you know, I ride all the time, but I train short distances and hard it's part of my morning routine.
Right.
So I don't use clips.
Okay.
Which I need to. Mm-hmm. And so also there's a part of me that just laughs at this, right? So first of all, for people who are interested, this was for, it's called Bike MS. It's a massive,
this is the important bit.
It's in the United States. I don't think they have a global, but there's probably global versions of it. And it's basically a massive fundraiser for multiple sclerosis research and stuff like that. I show up to this thing and I'm like, the kid who shows up with like, you know, my $5 bicycle with like shoes and everyone's in these like, you know, $10,000 bicycles
with all the kit,
suits and all the stuff. And I'm just looking around like, one of these things does not belong. One of these things is not like the others.
Yep.
And that would be me. Yep. But I held my own and, you know, we were one of the first groups to finish. We finished the 50 miles in 3.5 hours.
Yep.
So we maintained a pace of like, you know, somewhere was like between 15 and 16 miles an hour,
Yep.
Which is pretty good. And, but it also same thing I realized, I'm like, Without clips,
yeah.
I only have access to about half of the cycle stroke.
That's it, because on the upstroke, you can't pull up.
And, and I'll post it at somewhere because I use the Insta360. And so I have some cool, some cool video of it. And what's crazy is when you look at me and one of my cycling partners, like you, they literally are, their feet are moving twice as fast as mine. And I'm like, I held it with it. And it was just brute strength and just stubborn determination. But yeah, it was one of those.
Clips are a game changer.
And it was one of those things where I was like, okay, if I'm going to keep doing distances like this, I'm like, I need to get a little bit more serious with my with my equipment. So, you know, Christmas is going to come early around the Leahy household, I think. I don't know.
Talk about possible and preferable futures. This is in yours.
That's right. It's like new. I was like, I need the new kit. I need a new bike. I need new shoes.
Well, actually, the good news is that the shoes and the clips are a damn sight cheaper than the bike.
That's Well, and it's funny too, because like when you look at those bikes, you're just like, it is. I mean, again, having spent a lot of time in the Netherlands, like we know bikes and we know bikes are expensive, but there's a difference when you go for even those bikes. I mean, those bikes last forever and they're wonderful. But then when you go to like the racing, like road bikes, you suddenly you're just like, wait, is that for a car or do I get five bikes? You're like, no, that's one.
So it's funny. I just to wrap up this story because we should probably get on.
We'll jump in.
So when I was younger, I had this bike lust for what was then one of the best British road bikes around, Dawes Galaxy. Dawes, a great British company. And I eventually managed to purchase one. This is back in the 1990s. It cost me about £600 or so.
Oh, yeah.
Which is nothing compared to how much you pay for a bike these days. I mean, I've actually still got this bike. I love the bike.
Oh, that's cool.
But it just seems so low tech compared to what people are shelling out money on these days.
It's wild. And, you know, and this might surprise people that I actually resist overloading the tech angle of these things.
Right.
Because again, I'm usually like, it's just about just learn your body. It's just, you know, but I also, I appreciate too that some people don't know that and they need, they want like all these digital things to tell them like now is when you push harder. And I'm like, but just, you know, when your legs are burnt.
I just want to ride a bike.
Yeah, I'm like, when your legs are full of lactic acid, just stretch them out, man. Let it, like, that's not the time to push. That's time to let them relax. But so anyway, so it was a success. I survived. Great. I had a great time. And the bug is in me. I'm looking forward to, because I'd never done 50 miles at one time before.
Yes.
I think the longest I had done was 25 or something. So next year, the question is like, do I do the 70 or the century and go for the 100?
Yes.
Yeah. But I'm like, that's like 7 hours of cycling. I'm like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, why don't we just take a break and we'll jump in, because I think we've got a fun...
which actually ties in with this, talking about sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely. And being, and it's also, one of the things that's so beautiful about cycling like that is it gets you out into, you know, parts of, you know, for here in Arizona too, it was up in like the Fountain Hills, north of the valley.
Yeah.
A beautiful scenery. And again, you're faced directly with a lot of just these questions about how do we protect, how do we keep... It's sustainability just writ large, right? Like, how do we think about all these things, because again, sharing the road with cars as a cyclist, you're very aware of,
especially in America.
Yeah, the big diesel trucks that blow up the black smoke as they ride right next to the cycling lane.
Yep.
And I think give it a little bit of throttle on purpose, you know, right? The big plume of smoke comes
out. Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but in the UK, the word in those situations was you always carry a screwdriver.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep.
So you basically sort of, those cars that get too close.
It's like, that just reminded me real quick, like back in the days of Chariots and then over like, or in like the spy movies of the cartoons, is like you have the spikes on the wheels. You just gotta get like the bicycle version.
A little bit of road rage.
That's right. You know. Oh goodness. Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll jump into today's topic.
Initializing waveform.
Modulating signals for transmission.
Exploring the possible, probable, and preferable futures.
Welcome to Modem Futura. All right. I'm like, how do I recover from spikes on the wheels? I don't know. Right. But anyway, I'm Sean Leahy, joined by my co-host extraordinaire,
Andrew Maynard,
which means, hey, this is Modem Futura, the show that explores the intersection of technology, society, and the possible, probable, and preferable futures, asking deep questions like, what will it mean to be human in the future? And I think today's topic, I'm like, sometimes there are these topics that are so big and so profound and meaningful that I'm like, not sure we can grab all of it today, but we're gonna slice off a little chunk,
right? Yes.
And talk about this idea of, because when I think about, like, what does it mean to be human in the future, it's also a question along with that in terms of the sustainability is, mm-hmm. Will our planet be able to support that in the future?
That's right. And that connection between who we are and where we live, which is so deeply intertwined.
Yeah. Which, mm-hmm. I go all the way back. Even as a kid, I kind of had this weird sort of response to the slogans of, like, save the planet, mm-hmm. save the earth. Because it was one of those things where I'm like, I was a big surprise. Sean was a little nerd just the planetary science was always mm-hmm. a big thing. I was a right. huge, I was dreaming of being like an astronomer and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Loved it. But through that, you're studying the history, dinosaurs, of course, what kid doesn't love all that?
Right.
Right. So you learn the history of just what we know of our planet. And then this call for, at least going back to like the mid 80s, right? Which is like, Earth Day, save the mm-hmm. planet.
Yep.
And very quickly, I'm like, that's the wrong, like, great idea.
Right, yes.
The slogan should be save the humans.
Right.
Right? Because I'm like, the damage that we do yep. will be repaired once we're gone.
See, that's it. And so many people have said this before. The planet actually doesn't need us.
No.
Earth is going to be fine.
Be just fine.
The question is, are we going to have an environment that we can thrive in or not?
That's right.
And yes, you could argue that with sort of biodiversity loss, we can have such an impact that it's going to take a long time for the Earth to sort of rebound from that. But,
sure.
Life finds a way.
Well, and we are but a blip on the timeline right. We talk about the lifespan of Earth, mm-hmm. right? We know when it will end roughly, which is when our sun will swell to a red giant big enough where it'll boil everything off and swallow everything, whatever. Yes. Right.
So we're a few years away from that.
We're a few years, but we know how it ends.
Right.
Right. Yes, and I think the goal here is to have a habitable planet so mm-hmm. much that we, the humans, can thrive for as long as possible.
Right, yes. And of course, you've got the sort of slightly sort of edgy version of that that sort of says humans are irrelevant, that every form of life has got the right to thrive. And certainly there are people that are strong proponents of that, except that if you think about sort of really healthy ecosystems, you cannot ignore the fact of what humans are, humanity is, and how that fits in with these complex systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to attempt, I don't have it written down, so this is all from memory, but I'm going to attempt to apply it, which is why we define the time we're living in as the Anthropocene, mm-hmm. which is the geological age of the Earth to which humans have had a measurable impact on the Earth itself.
That's
right.
It. Yes. Yep. So, yep. And I would just throw in, I mean, it's a controversial term because if you're sort of looking at sort of geology over massive time periods, most sort of people that work in these time periods would say it's too early to sort of call something this. And yet, conceptually, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because we are now living in a time where our actions have a profound impact on the environment we live in. And that in turn has a profound impact on us. Yep. Sort of individually and yeah. as a society.
Yeah, and our entire ecosystem. Mm. I mean, I think, mm-hmm. It's funny too, because my oldest, who's almost 10 years old, we've been watching all the Jurassic Park
right, yes.
movies. Yep. In fact, we've got a drive coming up. I've queued up. I read the book when I was 10, and so it's time to listen to the audiobook of right. the original Jurassic Park. But again, the sequence, we've talked about the show a lot, but it's ridiculous. But it's fun. And but one of the things that makes you start questioning, I think, is really relevant, is even those things that, again, it's those even the second, third order changes for mm-hmm. when, for example, when you make these, or we oftentimes are like, wouldn't it be great if we could just get rid of all the mosquitoes and just all the things that you might find on,
all the bad things.
All the bad yes. things. But then not thinking through about the entire mm-hmm. ecosystem.
That's right.
In yes. terms of, yep. Why do we have to have bacteria? Can't we just remove all bacteria? No one would get, and it's like, right. But then what would happen if yeah. all that was gone? Not understanding. And I think, again, as we are today, I think what's really interesting, and I think a new part of this conversation that's joining now with this the massive understanding of sustainability mm-hmm. is also the technological signature right. of artificial intelligence.
Of course. Yes.
And yep. the ecosystem that the AI brings with it.
That's it. And this is where it gets so complex. And this is where we're sort of moving towards a new report that we'll be talking about. That the fact that if you look at AI and the emergence of data centers and AI training systems and everything around it, it is having a measurable impact on society. And as you project forward, you can see how that impact is going to increase. At the same time, we're developing technologies that are opening up completely new avenues
yeah.
for how we begin to imagine a sustainable future or a resilient future or however you want to sort of frame that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's really powerful to think about because again, and you know, through our catalog of shows, we've talked about all these different pieces, mm-hmm. right? I mean, just the energy levels required to support the AI boom, the mm-hmm. AI Cambrian explosion, however you want to think about it, right? I mean, that alone has its own sort of sustainability element.
Right.
I love the fact, I mean, it's not part of the report we'll talk about here in a moment, but even, you know, I think it was like last week or maybe the week before, episode before, we started talking about the digital sustainability.
Right.
And yes. that element.
Yes.
But
yep.
again, it's not just the surface level item. It's mm-hmm. the entire ecosystem that yes. supports that
That's
element.
Exactly. Yes.
And so it's really fascinating to think about those things because, and again, we've seen this time and time again, when the technology, you know, again, this idea of technology or tools having new and different or reimagined use cases.
Right. Yes.
I go back to the WEF, the top mm-hmm. 10.
Yep.
That a handful of them were not new innovations themselves.
They were how you actually apply them.
They were yes, new yep. applications.
And this to me is what makes that intersection between technology, society, and the future so exciting and so difficult to pin down because you can come up with a technology for a certain purpose, but humans are so ingenious
yeah.
that you can guarantee that somebody is going to find a way of using that you never, ever imagined or thought of.
Yeah.
And that's the excitement of innovation where you see these things happen. But it also means it's incredibly hard to predict where the downsides might be as everybody sort of takes these technologies and takes them in completely creative and unpredictable directions.
Yep. And I think core to that is also, you know, I think the term that's often used around tools or technologies, it's a mm-hmm. double-edged sword.
Right. Yes.
Right. Yep. But to put that in perspective too, because I think that is exactly right. And history so far has kind of borne that out.
Right.
That
yes.
with yep. these new technologies, you have, you know, this new thing comes up, this new innovation, we think about mm-hmm. new ways, the ingenuity of the human species to then yep. find all these interesting ways of doing that to yep. so far overcome harms and things like that.
Not yes. yep.
in the long run. But then there's also the caution of the over-reliance of that, mm-hmm. of saying like, oh, well, don't worry. Like that comes, that's the part we talk about often yeah. too, is like, well, don't worry about the damage that this new thing's going to cause.
Somebody will sort it out.
Someone
yeah.
will be smart enough to solve it later. Right, so we right. don't need to worry. And so there's always that danger
is,
of
yeah.
like, we want to ensure that can happens, but right. not count on it.
And it's an unbelievably naive perspective.
Yeah.
It's the perspective of somebody who has never studied risk and impacts. Because
yeah.
even if nothing else, you've got the lag. So basically, say you have a technology where every day it kills 1,000 people. And you say, don't worry about it, because in a year or so, we'll find a solution to this. In the meantime, before you find that solution, 1,000 people yep. a day dying. So that's the price you pay.
Yep.
And it's a very, very sort of naive sort of hypothetical,
sure.
but it's the case with every single technology. There's a lag between the negative impacts and how we begin to sort of come out of that.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a bad thing because this is just how innovation and society and the messiness of this planet and this life works.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I do think that it becomes an important factor in how we make decisions, and to ignore that basically ignores something that is profoundly important to the people that are affected.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, again, it's like, I'll pull out my drum, I'll stand up on my soapbox
yep.
and say, this is when we need to apply futures thinking.
Of course, also, yes,
because,
yes. Yeah.
Because I think oftentimes though that, you know, whether it's like arrogance or ignorance mm-hmm. or just, you know, completely being unaware is also born out of the thing that people don't think long-term.
Right.
Right.
Yes,
and culturally too, there's elements that some cultures naturally are more ingrained to think long-term versus others that think very short-term.
Right.
You know, especially in a situation like here in the United States, when things, you know, you think from a a public company perspective, things are very short. It's quarterly. Yes. It's
right.
year over year earnings. It's stock market. You know, you're playing to these things with more emphasis on the short-term gain than the long-term effect, which causes bad decision-making.
Of course, yes.
You know,
yes.
Oftentimes for long-term stuff. Because you mentioned that risk of, you know, if you harm 1,000 people or, mm-hmm. you know, this technology, and this is part of the criticism. Again, I've mentioned that group before, that sort of the Tescreal group it's kind of faded from
the criticize sort of this very, very optimistic thinking about the future.
Yeah. Yes. And part of that is also at the expense of today.
That's where
mm-hmm. you really get into this really difficult sort of ethical and moral entanglement.
Yes.
Is even if you're thinking, well, you know, in 100 generations from now, we'll prosper, but at the cost of what? Right. The cost of removing entire cultures and civilizations.
And again, this has got to be a discussion. And so because there's never zero risk.
No.
There are always prices to pay for the innovations we create and the progress, inverted commas, we make. You can't avoid that. That's effectively, if you go back to physics, that's thermodynamics. It's living in a dynamic system. But we do have the ability to choose sort of where those wins and loses are, basically who pays and who gains and how we distribute the risk.
Yeah. And that's, I want to emphasize that because that's a huge piece to all of this, whether it's about sustainability or other tech, but that again is part of the process that's built in with futures thinking and future studies to assume that there would be no risk is a fool. I mean, that if someone's telling you that, you are being sold snake oil.
Well, I may have said this on this podcast before, but this is what I teach my students.
Yeah.
You can have zero risk, but the way to get zero risk is to be dead.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the trade-off.
Probability
do you want risk
of
and
one.
Be alive or no risk and be dead.
That's right. And so that is you know, you're being sold a load of BS when that's happening. But the responsible approach is there's going to be risk. Mm-hmm. Here's what we anticipate the risk to be.
Yep.
Here's why we think that's acceptable because of the long-term benefit outweighs the, and here's how we're going to try to mitigate that risk, right? And that's the key piece that's often missing.
Of course, I mean, I actually didn't expect we would be talking about risk here, but this is one of my things. But whenever you talk about risk, there are multiple sort of dimensions. One of them is the nature of the risk and the nature of the impact. Because if we're talking about a sprained ankle, that is very, very different from somebody getting cancer, for instance. Got to think about both the type of impact and the magnitude of impact. And then you've got to talk about probabilities. And most people sort of understand this intuitively. If you tell them sort of you do something and there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that you're going to sort of get a scratch on your finger, they'll think, that sounds okay. If you tell them there's 1 in 1,000 chance that you're going to die of cancer, that's a very, very different calculus.
Different thing. Well, and I think too, I mean, a lot of people might be able to also envision this because I think it was interesting going back to the film Oppenheimer, right? Where they're showing that sort of this, you know, the sort of the behind the scenes here and some of the calculations of understanding like, hey, we've not done this before. Mm-hmm. We know the pressures. If we need to do it before the enemy does it, because this will stop the war, all this blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
The other risk is it could light the entire atmosphere on fire.
Right.
There is a possibility that this might happen. And so that was the use. And again, what's scary when you think about that is you have a room full of like 10 people, really, you know, maybe even less in terms of making the decision. And ultimately maybe it was just down to a couple people making the decision globally. Like, you know, this, you know, talk about simulation. That one could have ended that could have ended badly.
Well, actually, what you don't realize, that was in a previous simulation.
Right.
Thankfully, we're in the simulation where everything worked out okay.
That's right. Well, if you're a subscriber of the Many Worlds series, that one did, one of them did ignite the atmosphere. Yes. And, you know, that one just got turned off. That branch was pruned, you know. But it is. I think that's a good way, because people oftentimes are like, well, yeah, but what do you mean? Like, I'm like, no, that was a realistic existential risk that they had to calculate as the world was burning from conflict, it was,
Do we do this?
Yeah. Do we do this? Do we take that risk? And mm-hmm. you know, the risk, the potential was small, but not zero.
Yes.
And that's always a fun thing when you're like, there's a non-zero chance that this will.
Also to bring this in, I mean, so this is sort of a term of art almost. But when you're talking about risk, you tend to talk about de minimis risk, the risk which is low enough that people would generally consider, or a reasonable person would consider to be acceptable. And it's usually one in a million if it's not in special circumstances. So generally, sort of when people are having risk discussions and making risk decisions, they'll say, if we do the calculations and there's a one in a million chance that something will go wrong, the assumption is most people would be happy to live with that. But it does change with circumstances.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. And so the end of the world as we know it is, you probably want to go sort of even lower than one in a million.
I mean, I don't know. You
can imagine the discussion. You know, I think it's one in 999,999. Do we go or do we not?
Yeah. You know, and the reverse is true when you're trying to pick a lottery ticket and you're like, what's your chances of winning? It's one in like 35 million. You're like, do I really have a chance at this? Yeah. And then when it gets high enough, right? When that mega ball gets high enough, man, you're like, I guess I'll play. Yeah. All right. So anyway, so let's
this is all a very, very long segue into this new report from the Stockholm Resilience Center.
Yeah, which, like I said, this is too big of a thing for us to tackle. So we're just taking a little
slice. So we're just avoiding it.
You know what? The best way is to just vamp all the way around it until we run out of time. And then we're like, sorry, folks. This is hey, if I've learned nothing, it's like we can always leave them wanting more.
There we are.
But yeah, so I want to talk about this because you popped out a Substack article and then there's other stuff happening around this, but I want to draw attention. So there's a new report was just released called AI for a Planet Under Pressure. Mm. It was a 2025 synthesis report from the Stockholm Resilience Center and the Potsdam Institute of Climate Impact Research. And it posed this central question, and I'll read the question here. The question is, can artificial intelligence be used responsibly and effectively to help humanity navigate climate change, biodiversity loss, freshwater crises, and other planetary pressures without worsening those pressures in the process?
Yep.
We had just mentioned the environmental impact, the energy impact of those of mm-hmm. using AI itself. And so I think it was a really interesting sort of perspective of taking, a lot of these, I would say traditional, but well-known sustainability climate challenges and asking the questions around, well, how could AI be used to help this or hurt this or what's the deal?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, this is all in the context of efforts to really address either climate change or what sort of some people call planetary health. How do you sort of build a sort of a healthy planetary sort of ecosystem that incorporates everything. This comes on the tail of so many discussions where people are beginning to realize we're just not making the progress that we feel we need to make.
Yeah.
There are so many challenges and we seem to be nibbling away at some of these challenges, but still those challenges exist. I mean, you just need to look at the Sustainable Development Goals.
Sure.
To realize that they're great, they're aspirational, but we don't seem to be changing the world that fast. So something needs to change. How we do this.
Yeah, I feel like that is a constant point of friction, which is, from the technological side of things seem to move at a lightning, know what I mean? It was not even 3 years ago yet, right? I guess it is it'll be 3 years ago, like real soon, when ChatGPT burst through the door, right? It's like 2 weeks away or something.
I know, yes.
But that's only been 3 years.
I know, yes.
Right? And yet, if you go back, I'm like, I've been aware of the climate impact and all this stuff for at least 30,
right?
And it goes way beyond that.
Oh, yes.
That's
40, 50 years. Yeah. More than that, actually, people
and
have been
that's
sort
just
of grappling
my,
with this. Yes,
that's
yeah,
just
yeah,
my
yeah.
awareness of it.
Yep,
and it does feel like with all these new technologies, again, coming back to this idea of, well, the humans are very, very creative about solving, but it's like, why haven't we solved this yet?
Right.
Why are we still not solving these problems?
And the answer is these are incredibly complex problems within a complex system. So again, if you have a complex environment and then you put 8 billion people in there where you can't just tell them all to think and do the same thing. Everybody has got a certain degree of their own agency.
Yep.
It is an incredibly complex system that is almost impossible to sort of control and corral in certain directions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, actually, before we get to the question, I would say that the Stockholm Resilience Center are known in particular for their work not only on sort of resilient systems, but on planetary boundaries. So they've done a lot of groundbreaking work looking at how the different sort of planetary and environmental systems are reaching tipping points beyond which everything changes.
Yeah.
And we suddenly find ourselves either in crisis mode or in a very, very different sort of modality. And it's not just climate change. It is right. things like biodiversity. It's the flow of certain chemicals through the environment. It's what happens to our oceans yeah. as they get pushed beyond tipping points and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
So this is the context where they're asking, because we seem to be failing on so many fronts, is there something that AI can do that changes the game?
Yeah. And I think that's really important because, again, that's the thing. I mean, mm-hmm. we talk about, I mean, I think about one that I think hits a lot of people because they can understand it mm-hmm. is the concept of microplastics,
yes.
right? The fact that, you know, I think everyone would generally agree it's not good to have plastic inside your body,
right?
right? And then when they're like, oh yeah, there's plastic in, and then where it's showing up.
Yes.
Right. That it yep. is showing up in newborn, like unborn infants because right. it's being transferred yes. from mother to child.
Of, it's through everything.
Brain yes, barrier. Yes, like yes, the yes. fact that you, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And so, but there does raise those questions where mm-hmm. at some point, if it's like mm-hmm. you have, where is the tipping point of yes. where that becomes such a pervasive issue that you've gone past where you could
yes,
return yeah. it to the way it was and, naturally.
And plus the fact it's a great example of a near intractable problem. Certainly if you look at the microplastics out there,
yep.
you can't put the genie back in the bottle. I mean, it's like you sort of, you take a cup and smash it. You can't just reverse the world and end up with the intact cup. Sort of once sort of things have sort of smashed and sort of spread out, it becomes an incredibly difficult problem to get things back to where they were.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think about this a lot too, in the sense that, you know, cause we, again, even mm-hmm. in front terms of, certain technological processes, mm-hmm. whether it's in manufacturing or energy, that have addressed some of those challenges.
Yep.
You also then see issues for, again, in other parts of the world that, you know, if you look to, for example, China in the last, you know, 20 years in mm-hmm. terms of the amount of energy production that they've gone through in terms of their economic boom,
yep.
right? And at some point you would say, like, I mean, I remember reading this statistic. I mean, this was a decade ago or more at least, that, you know, how much more sort of fossil fuel and energy production that China was using than the United States or even the rest of the world.
Right, yes.
And the initial reaction would be like, well, they can't do that. How dare they? right. But they're like, but we did.
Right.
And so you also have yes. this, the social challenge of this too, of like,
yep.
of how can you tell one group, country, civilization, society, what have you, to not do the very thing that you did to gain your economic advantage in the world material advantage.
That's it. And of course, the interesting twist there is we're now beginning to see that China is leapfrogging the rest of the world in renewables. So,
yeah.
so they've gone through that transition.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, yeah. it's a fascinating case to look at because in a very short period of time, mm-hmm. it was like they were behind, then were overproducing, doing the same, sort of the same mm-hmm. pathway.
Yep.
But then as now, I mean, even just in terms of their electric vehicles, I mean, Mark, I mean, yes, they're amazing.
Yep.
And how they've gone so far in exactly that they are pioneering these renewable energy sources and things like that far yep. faster yep. than it feels like we are.
Right.
In the United States, in the Western sort of world.
So this actually brings up an aspect of AI and sustainable futures, which I don't think was hit on in the report. And the report is great. I would encourage anybody to read it.
Yeah, I'll make sure to link it in the show notes.
It is nuanced and sophisticated. It's sort of passing out of the different types of artificial intelligence and their applications is great. It's a must read. But it does fall short in some areas. And one of them, which is really interesting, it gets to this point of decision-making on a global scale, is asking the question, could sophisticated AI models actually help in fostering global cooperation? And I say this, I'm actually channeling a colleague, Athena Actopus, who is actually sort of developing a whole initiative in this area at the moment. So this is not me at all. And we're going to have Athena on the show.
Yeah, for sure. But
this is a really intriguing question. If we can't do this as humans, if our human sort of limited sort of ability to sort of work together gets in the way, can we somehow use AI as a moderator or a convener or something so we can find ways of working positively together so it's a win-win rather than a win-lose situation?
Yeah, that's fascinating because I'm like, at some point, if we won't believe each other because of all the hidden motives of like, I want more
AI peacemaker.
Yeah, yes. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, at some point, like, is this one of those places where mm-hmm. the AI, the potentially, I mean, again, I say this, even as I try to say these words, they're loaded with bias and all these things, right?
Yes, yeah.
But I'm like, would the like, you know, clear objectivity of this AI platform, removing all the bias and stuff of how it was built, trained, and developed, all that aside, would that be the peacemaker that would make it say like, this is in everyone's interest, because if you don't do it, you fools, you're going to go away. You're going to go away.
Probably wouldn't say you fools, but also, and again, I'm reflecting other people's work here. I'm very sensitive to this, but there is a whole lot of research and theory on cooperation and how even in human systems and biological and ecological systems, you see cooperation between species, between people, between communities, leading to win-win futures. So we have the theories there, we have the examples there. And so in principle, an AI can actually draw on those and offer different people around the table possibilities that they may be unaware of in terms of how they can move forward together. So in this way, it's just like sort of an expert system that reveals possibilities that maybe you can't see with your human brain.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it raises some great questions because I think that's one of the pieces. So I have a couple of questions that I've got down here to look at. And that's essentially one of them is also, is if you could have an AI system sort of acting as that intermediary.
Yes.
One, is that even by itself, is that an ethical acceptance to use it, right? So that's a big, so each one of these is like a mess. You can see how complicated this becomes and why I said, we're just going to scratch it.
We're basically going to sort of ramp up fossil fuel use to create the data centers for this AI that is going to help us solve the fossil fuel crisis.
I mean, right? It feels, sometimes it's like, I just want to put my head down. And just because I'm like, wait a minute, this feels so, the irony of some of this is also like this circular logic of like, yeah, exactly. We'll burn all the dinosaur bones in fossil fuels to power the generators that will run the data centers that are heating, that are, you know.
And in the novel or the movie about this, you have the scientists sitting around saying, it's a one in a million chance, but it's got to work.
We're going to burn it. It's got to work. Then somehow. In the third act.
Somehow it does.
Right?
Because everybody knows if it's a one in a million chance, it's bound to work.
That's right. Otherwise, why did they make a movie about it? Right? You know what I'm saying? But then it raises this question then, I guess, too, is like, you know, how do we justify that? Because the other piece then is even with that alone is like, do we think that the AI ecosystem fully can actually solve those planetary crises?
Yep.
If it's with, you know, even including its own environmental footprint,
right, yes,
in terms of energy, water,
e-waste. It feels a little recursive. Yes,
it does.
Yes,
and it's like, would it be possible to, same thing, right? You're like, well, we'll just burn it all, burn, baby, burn, and we'll hope that the one in a million shot that the end result will be some super, well, I don't know if it's some super intelligence or just very specialized, you know, intelligence system that could say, here's the plan and here's the thing. And then even with all that, can we trust it?
Yes.
Could you trust it? And could you trust that the models it's predicting?
Trust but verify.
That's right. Is it overfitting the models?
Right, I know,
You know, and so it's just, it is this.
There are so many questions, but actually if you pull back from there a little bit, because all of this is very, very speculative. One thing that the report does do is it doesn't sort of go into fantasy land with what AI can and can't do, but it looks at very, very practical.
That's our job.
That's why people listen to us. But what it does do is it asks very practical questions around, as we build these AI systems, either based on large language models or sort of extensions to those, and systems that can pull together data and patterns in very, very sophisticated ways and identify pathways forward which may otherwise be obscured, can we use these to find solutions that we couldn't otherwise see to specific problems? And it uses a number of examples where AI is already being used in this way in research.
Yeah.
Which I love the fact that they did this because it both shows that certainly within specific domains and on a small scale, we're beginning to see these AI models reveal possibilities that it would be very hard for researchers to see otherwise. And then it's very easy to say, well, why don't we take that two or three steps further and use it to find very practical, usually technical solutions to some of these big planetary problems.
Yeah. And I should say too, I think we've been talking about it. I just want to make sure that we say it as well, is that when we're talking about AI in this context, we're not just talking about like a chat bot, you know,
right?
Because a lot of people, that's the mind frame when we talk about AI is
just go to ChatGPT and say, how do we solve the world's problems?
You know what? That'd be kind of funny to do. Just type it in and be like, oh my God, I've solved it. Yeah, we're not talking just about like ChatGPT. We're also talking about the large AI.
That's right. So these foundation models or frontier models, which are vastly more complex than just the ChatGPT or the Claude that you might interact with.
Yeah. And we know there are examples of like, not AlphaGo. that's the Go play, but it's like AlphaFold.
AlphaFold. So this is one of the early ones from DeepMind, which allowed scientists to find new ways of sort of creating sort of proteins.
Yeah, and folding proteins and trying to figure out new combinations.
Yeah, I know a great example of how this is beginning to push things as humans work with the AI to make new discoveries.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, to me, one of the things that I find in terms of the sort of optimist side of this too, is I feel like these are, because so much of this world is quantifiable in terms of the observable science of what's happening, the measure, is that those are spaces in terms of building the models. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like scientific, these are computer generated models that we've been using for decades.
Yes.
The evolution of them is when you can feed them with real data and we can understand, like they are incredibly powerful at modeling these worlds and understanding and the advantage of now that we're getting to this place of having, you know, because of the AI boom, we're having enough compute power to really start to do these very complex modelings,
right?
In a way that we could do them faster and longer than any human could possibly do.
Yes. Yep.
Because again, all you have to do is keep burning those fuels and it'll keep running. They don't have to sleep. They don't have to eat. They don't, you know, aren't affected by.
You have a model that basically sort of says, if you run me for another 10 seconds, the amount of energy that I'm going to use is going to crash the world.
I know. And you know what's going to happen, right? We're going to get the answer.
Right. Yeah. And we know what that answer is. Yes.
Everything.
But the bottom line is these are potentially very powerful technologies, but there is a wrinkle here, and it's a wrinkle which AI may or may not be able to help us. And that is, as soon as you throw humans into the mix, things get complex.
Yeah.
So far too often in sustainability science, or at least some aspects of it, people look at technological solutions to problems or scientific solutions. They say, if only we can sort of do X, Y, and Z, sort of basically forget about people and let's just look at how we sort of create these technologies to sort of manage the environment, everything will be fine. And then humans become the biggest wrench in the works ever. and the reality is
we'll do weird stuff.
You cannot do anything about building a vibrant future, because by talking about a vibrant future, we're talking about a future where humans flourish without thinking about human behaviors, human weirdness, human sort of, I don't know, everything that we do, which just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yep.
And so the only way to move forward is you've got to somehow have AI systems that work with humans that not only look at the planetary systems, the non-human stuff, but also understand sort of human behaviors, human sort of heuristics and biases and sort of both individual behaviors as well as sort of community behaviors and how they fit into that. Now, it may be that we can build these models that have that level of sophistication, but they've got to be integrated. Yeah. And it gets very uncomfortable when we have these models telling us what we like in ways that we don't like.
Well, absolutely. And it kind of sets up this like human versus machine agency in terms of the planet, in a planetary emergency, right? And like, I mean, these questions that start to bubble up are like, you know, are we outsourcing our own responsibility?
That's
right?
It, yes.
And then by doing so, how does that, I mean, talk about like the, you know, confounding variables and all these challenges, right? Is like, so if humans, if we abdicate our responsibility, how does that change our behavior?
See, that's right. Yes.
Right.
Yep.
You know, because and it's like, will that same kind of tied to that is like the reliance on the AI diminish our urgency? Because again, don't worry about it. You know,
one of the huge issues that people have talked about for over decades. If we get too complacent in technology solving our problems, we stop actually striving to solve them.
Yeah. And then we stop, I mean, without that urgency. Because, I mean, again, if you look, you know, over just the last, you know, even just 200 years of human history, right? I mean, it is those crises, those urgencies that drive innovation. It's conflict. It's, you know, natural disasters. It's these things that, I mean, humans we're incredibly creative, and we're even more creative when it's like, your back is to the wall because like, you know.
But here's also the problem. So most people do not believe our back is against the wall. These are big, complex issues that span sort of years rather than minutes.
Yeah.
So intellectually, most people can understand we've got to do something to sort of create a sustainable, resilient and thriving future. But emotionally and practically when it comes to it, there are other things in the way. Yep. It is incredibly hard for us to commit to something where we give so much every day on the assumption that somebody else is going to benefit in the future. It's just not how society is wired.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I mean, I think you see this a lot of times with people who just, you know, for example, who will litter, like throw garbage on the ground or something, because like they know they should be recycling or throwing it away or whatever. But then you're like, well, nothing happened.
So then the question is, can AI somehow help with this? And I have no answer to this, but you've got sort of human behavior, both individual behavior and social behavior. Is there a way that an AI can either help us see things in a different light or even begin to nudge us in different ways so our natural proclivities to do things in a short-term way do not interfere with building the sort of future we actually want?
Yeah.
And that gets really scary. So you start to talk about nudging.
I mean, the minute you say that, I'm like, wasn't that kind of one of the plots of RoboCop originally? Was like, the robotic police officer, like, you have throw that garbage in the wastebasket. You're like, I did. And then they just get like blown away.
Right. That's right. Yes.
It's overcorrecting. You know, that we have an alignment problem here.
Well, maybe that will fix the solution.
I mean,
yeah, it's do or die.
You know what? This has actually walked us right to the alignment problem and the
paper. Right. Yes.
Oh, I see what, you know, I'll embody the voice of the super intelligent AI. Oh, I see the problem. Problem here. It's these weird humans.
Right. Yes. Eliminate them. Problem solved.
Solved. Yes. A couple quick buttons, a couple launch codes here and there, and problem taken care of.
That's right.
You know?
Yes. And, yes. Yep.
It's like very quickly you can see how that, you know, you start to walk down there and you're like, oh, look at that, our timer. Boom, boom, boom.
Time is out. Yes.
Our time is up.
Just ignore that.
I know. I do love that you can actually hear it. I don't remove it either because I'm like, it's kind of, people need
so
to know.
So now we're in extra time.
That's right. We're in overtime. Yes, yeah. This is just a fascinating conversation because it raises so many of these issues. But, and I think what our listeners take away from this one is, I hope they will actually go check this out too, if you're interested. Again, I'll make sure to link the report into the show notes, but it's understanding, like even just listening to us talk about this is how complex of an issue this is. Now, again, with all, you know, I kind of come back to this sort of social science, a terminology with wicked problems.
Yes.
Right. This is definitely one of those because now you can take a very sort of pragmatic, cold view, which I just did with the hypothetical here, is like, just remove the humans, problem solved.
Right.
Or again, as we talked at the very beginning, wait till we run ourselves out of room. The planet will be just fine and carry on. Right. You know, ask the dinosaurs how they feel about
right. You know, and I should say, because people so often get this wrong with wicked problems, a wicked problem, how it was initially defined, is a problem where the nature of the problem changes as you try and implement solutions. Yep. So it is so slippery that you can never find a solution to the problem because it's already changed by the time you think you have.
And that's exactly it. By the very definition, by Rittel and W.
Yes.
I almost had it. Poor Sean. I should have had that.
Yeah.
But that is exactly it. The nature of the wicked problem is that it is by definition unsolvable.
Yes.
Because every solution introduces new variables that change the nature. Yes. Yep. But so, and it's one of those things where, like, the way I've always talked about it as well, like with my students and things like that, is the goal of the wicked problem is not to be solved.
Yes.
The goal of the wicked problem is to frame it and understand that we're dealing with a wicked problem and to take a slice. And what you're working towards is incremental improvements.
Right.
So that you're making life and whatever it is better.
In an agile and resilient way.
In an agile and resilient way over time, knowing that the actions that you can take are not going to solve this problem. It's too big, it's too messy, and even your actions will introduce new challenges.
Yep.
But the goal is to take slice by slice by slice and work on making incremental adjustments and changes that, again, using that sort of responsible sort of approach, make things better.
Right.
And again, that's a loaded term, but
Right. Yes, that's right.
Improving the problem.
Yes. Yeah. And so bringing that back to sort of planetary health and sort of the future, the question is, can AI help us sort of do better with that, taking those slices and making incremental change and agilely responding to the new problems that come up? Can we craft a far better pathway forward than we can without AI? And in the Substack piece, I was quite provocative. I basically asked, is planetary health without AI moribund? I wanted to say, is it dead? But I thought that was a little bit too extreme. But the reality is, we're not only dealing with wicked problems at a planetary scale, but we're not actually doing very well at addressing them and even doing that slicing and moving forward. So can AI be a game changer here? If it is it an absolutely essential game changer without which we cannot see a future of human flourishing? Or are we blinding ourselves with that? And actually, is this a Trojan horse where if we begin to invest in it, we discover we've actually created a bigger problem than we're solving?
Yeah, exactly. That it's like the very thing. Yeah, exactly. Right. The irony there, right? The very thing that we were trying to create to solve the problem has made the problem worse that we can no longer, and now we're in a runaway.
And my only conclusion was the only thing we can do, we have to have the conversation. If we do not have the conversation, somebody else is going to make these decisions for us. We have to be talking about how on earth we navigate this, not only as individuals, but as whole communities.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the one last thing I would say too, is I'll bring up this sort of like saying or proverb, which I don't appreciate because it brings into my spirit animal, which is the elephant. But it's this conversation, right, with wicked problems is like, you can't eat an elephant in one bite.
Right.
So you have to take little slices. And I'm like, don't you ever dare take a bite out of an elephant. Or Sean will come after you. But what I like about that analogy, or maybe we'll use like a brontosaurus or something we can't ever do.
Right.
But where I get, again, perhaps optimistic about the role of AI systems in that is helping us understand which slices to take now or to stack or in order of operations to help us reach a desirable alignment goal that we as humans can hopefully agree upon.
Right.
Yes. And I think every human would agree, I hope so, that the ultimate goal is to ensure that we can be here on this planet and flourish in the future so that future generations will have an opportunity to grow up and not in a, you know, punishing environment to which they cannot survive.
Yes.
I mean, I think as humans, we are genetically coded for survival.
Sure. And just to sort of one final thought there, what if there is something here that we're missing, which is a win-win. It's a win for the near term and a win for the future term for the majority of people around the planet. It's just that we can't see it. But AI, because it can pull in all of these data sources, all of these perspectives from all around the globe and through history, can reveal that possibility to us.
Yeah.
I mean, if that was possible, it would be a game changer. Nobody knows whether it is, but surely that's something that it's worthwhile exploring.
Absolutely, because maybe there's something just out of reach, just out of sight that is sitting right in front of us, but we just haven't been able to see the picture.
We need a bit of help. Yes.
To put it together. Yep. Oh, fantastic. Awesome. Well, I promised we'd take a slice and we did. We scratched. this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you, Andrew. I think, you know, there's a lot in here.
I know. Yeah. Lots to unpack over the coming weeks.
Lots to unpack. And if you want to unpack it, can you continue supporting Modem Futura by your wonderful subscribes and shares. And again, please, there's just a call for, again, helping us continually reach more people and more tops of more charts. One of the best ways to do that, of course, is to subscribe to our shows, follow it wherever you get your podcast, but also to leave us a rating and review because that helps the machines.
Enormously.
Enormously. Yes. That's one of the best ways that new people can find us is through those ratings and reviews. So that would be much appreciated. And we'll be coming back to a lot of these elements and pieces because this is a rich, we got the toenail of the elephant. There's a lot more to talk about.
We're chewing on it now.
God. Oh, I love my elephants. Oh, it hurts my elephants. That's fantastic. We'll pick this conversation up on a future episode of Modem Futura. So from Andrew and myself, thank you very much. And we'll see you on the next episode of Modem Futura.
We'll see you then.
Demodulating signal.
Modem Futura is a production of the Future of Being Human Initiative at Arizona State University. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. To learn more about the Future of Being Human initiative and all of our other projects, please visit us on the web at futureofbeinghuman.asu.edu.
End transmission.